Explore the mystery at shrouduniversity.com.
Okay, good afternoon. I'd first like to thank Joe Marino, Sue Benford, and the Shroud Science Group for providing me with the opportunity to present my hypothesis that an obscure church custom known as the Discipline of the Secret has for more than 18 centuries effectively concealed the Shroud's critical role in the evangelization of Edessa. Thirty years ago, Ian Wilson identified the Shroud with the image of Edessa, an icon datable to 569, and employed the Abgar legend to account for the relic's whereabouts during the half millennium spanning its disappearance from Christ's tomb and its reappearance in 6th century Edessa, the so-called ancient missing years. The Syriac edition of that legend, which is rooted in the 3rd century, told of the disciple Adai presenting a Christ portrait to King Abgar Ukama shortly after the crucifixion. The original 4th century Greek tale recited merely that Abgar saw a miraculous vision appear on the face of Adai. These two literary allusions presently constitute the entirety of known proof, derivable from classical antiquity, that the Shroud was once present in Edessa. However, I believe that three additional pieces of ancient evidence can be introduced in support of that case. Several accretions to the Abgar legend developed during the Middle Ages. In about 593, Evagrius reported that the then-venerated Edessan icon, not made by hands, had, some 50 years earlier, helped the city resist a siege by the Persian army. While asserting that this sacred object had once been presented to Abgar Ukama, Evagrius provided no explanation for its ancient hiatus. In 945, and after the image of Edessa had been forcibly transferred to Constantinople, its new custodians invented a story that in the middle of the first century, the relic was hidden in the walls of Edessa, where it lay forgotten until its rediscovery in 544. It was, to a substantial degree, this Byzantine embellishment which became the Mandylion theory's account of the ancient missing years. Nevertheless, the Mandylion theory does set forth an extremely credible medieval syndonic biography woven around a cogent presentation of highly relevant information which Wilson had expertly extracted from ecclesiastical history. And if the Shroud is to be successfully traced into ancient times, it will assuredly be necessary to obtain and consider information pertinent to early church history, traditions, rites, and customs. As I hope to demonstrate, it is just such a custom which has concealed the ancient connection between the Shroud and the Edessa. As it is self-evident that the Shroud did not arrive in Edessa in advance of a Christian missionary, it becomes critical to determine precisely when and how the gospel was first preached there. J.B. Siegel, whom Wilson calls the best modern authority on Edessa, believes the Abgar legend to be one of the most successful pious frauds of antiquity, and yet he acknowledges that it might well contain, within its mythical account of the city's conversion, a substratum of fact. In that light, it is important to note the following. One, the doctrine of Adai features contemporaries of King Abgar the Great, who reigned from 177 to 212. Two, its protagonist king allowed the erection of a church, and during Abgar the Great's reign, a flood partially destroyed an Edessan church. And three, an ancient Syriac manuscript of the Abgar legend relates that Severus, the son of Abgar, killed the disciple Adai, and the son of Abgar the Great, not Abgar Ukama, was named Severus. This apparent substratum of fact is historically complemented by both Eusebius' report that during the reign of Abgar the Great, a Christian synod was held in his kingdom, and also Abgar the Great's use of Christian imagery on his official coinage. Thus, the totality of the historical evidence appears to support an inescapable conclusion that Edessa was evangelized during the reign of Abgar the Great. However, a satisfactory identification of the underlying circumstances has thus far remained elusive. Logic and reason defy the belief that a Christian missionary simply appeared uninvited in pagan Edessa and managed to convert its king. But certain literary records, long misunderstood and ignored, explain how this event may have transpired. As he did again last evening, in his Grail presentation, Professor Scavone had previously drawn attention to a 6th century entry in the Liber Pontificalis, which records that Eleutherius, whose papacy extended from 174 to 189, received a letter from a British King Lucius, requesting that he be made a Christian. In 731, the Venerable Bede reported that Eleutherius promptly effectuated that king's request. However, because Britain was then under Roman rule and had no king, the entries presented a historical conundrum, which remained unsolved for almost 14 centuries, until in 1904, Adolf Harnack, a respected biblical scholar, deduced that the Liber Pontificalis entry had been intended to reference not Britain, but rather the Britia, Edessa's citadel, and not King Lucius, but King Lucius alias Septimius Magus Abgarus VIII of Edessa, otherwise known as Abgar VIII, or Abgar the Great. Harnack's solution of this literary puzzle also serves to provide an answer to the historical enigma surrounding Edessa's conversion, as the invitation of a missionary by the king himself would completely explain how Christianity was successfully preached in a pagan city, and the story of that mission would readily provide the substratum of fact that underlies the Abgar legend. The date of the Eleutherian mission's arrival in Edessa can be closely approximated by a logical application of known historical facts. The Roman Empire's more than century-long persecution of the early church continued through the reign of Marcus Aurelius, who died in 180. His son Commodus, entirely devoted to the pursuit of his personal pleasures and reportedly married to a Christian, was unusually tolerant of the church. However, upon his assassination on December 31, 192, a political power struggle ensued, and 6 months later, an anti-Christian emperor, Septimius Severus, emerged victorious to rule the empire for the next 18 years. Therefore, it seems very clear that only during the laissez-faire reign of Commodus from 180 to 192 could a papal mission to Edessa have been both safely undertaken and successfully completed. That Abgar was, in fact, baptized during the reign of Commodus is further confirmed by his portrayal with a cross-featured tiara on an Edessan coin bearing the image of that emperor. However, upon the ascension of Septimius Severus, shown on this Edessan coin, a cluster of stars substitutes for the cross on Abgar's tiara. And on this coin, it is a crescent moon which adorns the king's headdress. In 195, Abgar imprudently supported the Parthian enemy, and the emperor took the rule of Edessa from him and gave it to a Roman procurator. On the arch of Septimius Severus, located in the Roman Forum, the king's divestiture is artistically depicted. As a result, Abgar remained politically impotent until 197, when he was restored to power after assisting Rome to defeat Parthia. The foregoing chronology demonstrates two historical realities. One, Eleutherius, shown here, could have dispatched a papal mission to Edessa only during the reign of Commodus and prior to his own death in 189. And two, on a political level, Abgar could not have accepted baptism after Septimius Severus became emperor in 193, allowing for enough time to confirm Commodus's religious policies. The Eleutherian missionary would probably have left Rome no earlier than the year 183. Professor Glanville Downey, the preeminent historian of ancient Antioch, has concluded that Edessa was actually evangelized in two distinct phases, an initial and late second century effort, resulted in a religious hybrid of Christianity and paganism, while a second and final endeavor, instigated in 198, established Orthodox Christianity in the city by the year 200. It is, I propose, the first and incomplete conversion of Edessa, which included the baptism of its king, that was accomplished by the Eleutherian mission mentioned in the Liber Pontificalis and later confirmed by the Venerable Bede. And there is but one documented late second century ecclesiastical journey which began in Rome and ended in Mesopotamia, an expedition undertaken by the Phrygian bishop of Hierapolis, Aversius Marcellus. During the reign of Commodus, Aversius and Eleutherius led the church's struggle against a widespread and Phrygian-based heresy known as Montanism. Bishops of that period, including Irenaeus, made regular pilgrimages to Rome to confer with the Pope about its suppression, and Aversius would certainly have traveled to Rome to help plan and effectuate Orthodox strategy. When he died, between 192 and 212, Aversius left behind an epitaph which recounts his journey from Rome to Mesopotamia, an inscription which, scholars agree, implicates a forgotten chapter in early Christian history, and in particular, an obscure ancient church custom that is known as the discipline of the seeker. In the 17th century and immediately following the Reformation movement begun by Martin Luther, Protestant theologians attacked a number of traditional Christian doctrines as being absent from the teachings of the early church fathers. Catholics demonstrated that during the centuries following the crucifixion, these tenets were not mentioned because the clergy had faithfully observed a mandated convention which banned the public divulgence of religiously sensitive information. Evidence of this custom was cited in many late 2nd century and early 3rd century clerical writings, including those of Origen and Tertullian. For example, Clement of Alexandria counseled that ecclesiastical laws must not be communicated because of the mysteries contained in them. And in a dialogue authored by Minucius Felix, a pagan character observes that the Christians know one another by secret signs. Additional proofs contained in the subsequent writings of Cyril of Jerusalem, Basil the Great, Gregory Nazianzen, and Ambrose established the centuries-long prevalence of this ancient practice, and for purposes of common reference, the contending apologists labeled it the discipline of the secret. Initially, the discipline was directed only toward catechumens, but as Roman imperial persecutions intensified, it was greatly expanded to prevent pagans from obtaining any information that could be employed against the church and its faithful. And the clergy utilized coded language, metaphorical expressions, symbolic representations, and allegorical narratives in all faith-sensitive communications capable of discovery by non-believers. Christ was represented as a fish and in other cryptic forms. Bread and wine were called the symbols. Baptism was known as the seal, and certainly any allusion to a holy relic would have been similarly cloaked. Discarded in the 5th century and completely forgotten for more than a millennium thereafter, the discipline has never been taken into account in the search for the Shroud's ancient history. However, by applying its precepts to three ancient Christian texts, I believe that the relic's previously concealed role in the evangelization of Edessa is dramatically revealed. The first such text is the epitaph of Aversius Marcellus, famously known as the Inscription of Aversius. Discovered in 1883 and reliably dated to the end of the 2nd century, it is universally recognized as the queen of all ancient Christian inscriptions. Its content was reconstructed from stone fragments now on display in the Vatican Museum. A highly fictionalized 4th century biography of Aversius, which fully quotes the then extant epitaph, and the Inscription of Alexander, an imitation of the epitaph, datable to the year 216. The Inscription of Aversius specifically declares itself to contain a hidden message understandable only by Christians. He that discerneth these things, every fellow believer, namely, let him pray for Habersius. And scholars concur that the epitaph is in fact written in a mystical and symbolical style according to the discipline of the secret. However, every previous translation and interpretation of this inscription has been rendered by a person completely unmindful of either the shroud's possible ancient provenance or its putative link to Edessa. In light of the modern consensus, which now dates to the same era, both the evangelization of Edessa and the epitaph's creation, this inscription must be closely re-examined, not only in accordance with the precepts of the discipline, but also in a syndonic context. Habersius first recounts that he traveled to Rome at the command of a holy shepherd, undoubtedly his longtime anti-Montanist colleague, Pope Eleutherius, and that he saw there a people bearing a shining mark, clearly a metaphorical reference to baptized Christians. He also reports seeing majesty and a golden-robed and sandaled queen, previously thought to be allusions to the emperor and the church. However, I suggest that this passage requires reconsideration in the specific context of Abgar's letter requesting baptism. Correspondence of such a sensitive nature would surely have been carried to the Pope only by the king's closest confidant, and in the Edessan royal hierarchy, that official was the Pascriba. Inasmuch as Abgar's Pascriba was his father-in-law Manu, a new interpretation of this passage may be warranted. As Siegel has observed, a remarkably clear picture of women's dress at Edessa is obtainable from mosaics and sculptures of that period. For example, in the family portrait mosaic, the woman on the right wears a long golden robe over a green tunic. In the tripod mosaic, the woman on the right wears a golden tunic covered by a tan robe. And in the funerary couch mosaic, the seated woman on the right wears an exquisite golden robe over a red tunic. Other mosaics and sculptures from the same period portray Edessan women wearing golden bracelets, clasps, and necklaces. Perhaps then, it would be more than idle speculation to suggest that Abgar's wife, Queen Shalmath, accompanied her father to Rome, and that it is she to whom Habersius refers as the majesty which he contemplated there, and the queen, golden-robed and golden-sandal, whom he saw. Upon departing Rome, Habersius traveled to Syria, as the succeeding portion of the inscription reads, "And I saw the land of Syria and all its cities, and the Sebas I saw when I passed over Euphrates." This passage confirms that Habersius visited both Antioch and Edessa, for in the late 2nd century, Antioch was Syria's capital and the third most important city in the entire Roman Empire, and Edessa was considered the chief city in the eastern part of Syria. The fastest, safest, and most frequently traveled Syrian route to the Sebas was the Silk Road, which ran from Antioch and directly past Edessa, and it is unthinkable that Habersius would have bypassed this beautiful and important city on his way to Mesopotamia. In fact, it is the glaring absence of a specific mention of Edessa in a Syrian travelogue known to have been constructed in accordance with the discipline, which makes it all the more likely that something historic, but far too dangerous to acknowledge, transpired there during the course of his journey. The doctrine of Addai relates that Paulut, Addai's disciple, assumed leadership of the Edessan church, and history records that in 198, Bishop Serapion of Antioch delegated the cleric Paulut to establish Orthodox Christianity in Edessa. 2 years later, Paulut was consecrated the city's first bishop, and for many years after his death, Edessan Christians were called Paulutians. The succeeding passage of the epitaph states, "But everywhere I had brethren, I had Paul." Considering Paulut's identification as Edessa's bishop in the Abgar legend, his known historical role in the late 2nd century conversion of Edessa, and Habersius' use of metaphorical language throughout the inscription, this verse may merit the following interpretation. Palut was my companion on my journey through Syria. In 1999, I published a paper entitled Antioch and the Shroud, which suggested that in the late 2nd century, the Shroud was in the custody of the Church of Antioch. And I submit that the following passage of the epitaph reveals that, upon his departure from Antioch, Aversius was entrusted with the Shroud for presentation to Abgar. Faith everywhere led me forward, and everywhere provided as my food a fish of exceeding great size and perfect. It is universally accepted that the fish of this passage is Christ, and there is simply no logical reason why Aversius, a practitioner of the discipline, would express that the fish provided to him for his journey was of exceeding great size and perfect, other than to metaphorically describe a 14-foot long linen cloth bearing an anatomically perfect image of Jesus' body. By way of contrast, the inscription of Pectorius, dated to the same era, proclaims, "Eat with joy and desire, holding the fish in thy hands." And the metaphorically small size of this fish clearly alludes to Christ in the specie of a Eucharistic servant. Absent the benefit of syndonic considerations, interpreters of Aversius's epitaph have regarded its fish passage as just another reference to the Eucharist. However, a communion serving would simply not be described as being of exceeding great size, and such an allusion would be redundant, inasmuch as the symbols of bread and wine are specifically and separately mentioned at the conclusion of the same passage. The doctrine of Adai acknowledges, and Professor Downey concurs, that despite the king's conversion, Edessa's principal pagan altar remained intact and religious cultism continued to flourish in the city. Under such circumstances, the shroud could not be left in Edessa, and would surely have been returned by Palut to the safety and security of Antioch. Aversius traveled on to Nisibis before returning to Hierapolis to dictate his epitaph. And one must question why. Unless he had successfully completed a historic evangelization mission to Edessa, he would have publicly inscribed the details of an otherwise unremarkable journey which implicated no event important enough to merit protracted remembrance. Given the anti-Christian policies of Septimius Severus, no one could take credit or acknowledge responsibility for the evangelization of Edessa and the baptism of its ruler. By about 201, any such admission would have become fatal under a new imperial edict which specifically prohibited conversions to Christianity. So just how was this dilemma to be resolved? How could what was arguably the most historically significant event in Christianity since the resurrection be acknowledged and recorded without incurring the dire consequences that its publication was certain to bring about? According to Siegel, the official account of Edessa's evangelization, like all other portions of the Edessan archives, was authored by the king's scribe. Whatever may have originally been reported about the event, the public records were assuredly revised after Septimius Severus became emperor in 193, and again in about 201 after the edict banning conversions was issued. By that time, Orthodox Edessan Christianity was firmly in place. And if the participants in the king's baptism were to remain safe, the royal scribe would have to convey the story of the city's evangelization pursuant to the precepts of the discipline. Although the official archive of Edessa has not survived time, its account of Edessa's conversion was faithfully copied sometime during the 3rd century into the ancient Christian text known as the Doctrine of Adai, a work which specifically acknowledges the city's public records to be the source of its patently allegorical narrative. The historical Abgar the Great, a 2nd century king seeking spiritual redemption, becomes, in the ancient Syriac legend, Abgar Ukama, a 1st century monarch in search of a physical cure. His correspondence to the Pope becomes his distant predecessor's letter to Jesus. His courier, Manu the Pasgrīva, becomes Hainan the archivist. Eleutherius, who authorizes the papal mission, becomes Jesus, who approves a posthumous apostolic mission. Aversius, the pope's emissary, becomes Adai, Christ's designee. Pollute, Aversius's companion, becomes Agai, Adai's principal aide. And the shroud, the awe-inspiring proselytizing device that accompanied the Eleutherian mission, becomes both a portrait of Jesus with choice pigments and a marvelous vision that appeared to Abgar in the face of Adai. The royal scribe's painstakingly cautious and allegorically perfect modification of historical facts in the official archive effectively shielded not only those who had participated in the baptism of the king, but also the precious passion relic which had played such a critical role in that event. The allegorical nature of the narrative contained in the doctrine of Adai is confirmed by Adai's deathbed directives to his followers. Do not investigate secrets, nor ask concerning hidden things written in the sacred books which you possess. But the unbelievers give offense in them because they lacked the concealed eye and the hidden mind. In doing so, the story's Aversius figure emphatically proclaims the Syriac Abgar legend to be a product of the discipline, just as the real Aversius proclaimed his epitaph to be a product of that same ancient church custom. The third Christian text of classical antiquity, which metaphorically establishes the shroud's presence in Edessa at the turn of the 3rd century, is a Syriac poem best known as the Hymn of the Pearl. It is datable to the early part of the 3rd century and was written no later than the year 224. Of obvious Gnostic Christian origin, its promotion of certain heretical tenets establishes it as a Bardistanus work, which was, in all likelihood, composed by or at the direction of Bardison himself. Bardison, a Gnostic Christian, philosopher, and composer, was noble-born and, according to tradition, attended school with the young Abgar the Great. Siegel notes that certainly he frequented the court of Edessa, and the Doctrine of Adai relates that the portrait of Jesus was placed in one of Abgar's palaces. As the king's lifelong friend and a frequent visitor to his royal court, Bardison would certainly have viewed the portrait, and he is no doubt the source of the metaphorical allusions to it that appear in the Hymn of the Pearl. This poem is patently crafted in accordance with the precepts of the discipline, and a certain significance must also be attached to the fact that it was interpolated into the early 3rd century Acts of Thomas, the very apostle who, in the Abgar legend, dispatches Adai to Edessa. As with the inscription of Aversius, the entirety of the Hymn of the Pearl has never been considered in a syndonic context. And as with the Doctrine of Adai, its mystical text presents, upon close examination, a perfect syndonic allegory. The protagonist prince, the son of the king, represents Jesus, the Son of God, and his robe represents Christ's burial cloth. At the beginning of the poem, the robe is as imageless as the new linen purchased by Joseph of Arimathea is clean. The mission assigned to the prince by his father, wresting a pearl from the hold of a serpent, represents the mission entrusted to Christ by his heavenly father, the redemption of humanity from the hold of Satan. At the end of the poem, and only after his mission has been successfully completed, can the prince see his robe in an entirely different light. On a sudden, as I faced it, the garment seemed to me like a mirror of myself. I saw it all in my whole self. Moreover, I faced my whole self in facing it. For we were two in distinction, and yet one in one likeness. And the image of the King of Kings was depicted in full all over it. It is entirely clear that the post-mission appearance of a mirrored image of the prince upon his previously imageless robe represents the post-crucifixion appearance of a mirrored image of Christ upon his burial cloth. The robe's reflecting images symbolize the ventral and dorsal syndonic images, and the prince's declaration that he can see on the robe his whole self confirms that while at the Edessan royal court, Bardeyson had observed the entire body image on the shroud, just as Aversius Marcellus, the missionary who had brought the cloth there, had seen the anatomically perfect fish in its exceeding great size. More than a century before the Hymn of the Pearl was written, the Book of Revelations referred to Jesus as the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords, and the poem's pronounced depiction of the King of Kings in full and all over the prince's robe is an exact and precise replication of the shroud's portrayal of Christ's entire tortured and crucified body. In conclusion, I would submit that the shroud's presence in ancient Edessa is historically corroborated by 1, medieval textual evidence in the Liber Pontificalis, which reports King Abgar the Great's request that Pope Eleutherius send an evangelization mission to Edessa. 2, medieval textual evidence in Bede's church history, which confirms that Eleutherius promptly effectuated that request. And 3, ancient textual evidence in the inscription of Aversius, the Doctrine of Adai, and the Hymn of the Pearl, adduced through an application of the precepts of the Discipline of the Secret, which reveals that Bishop Aversius Marcellus led that mission and presented the full body image shroud to Abgar, whom he then baptized into the Christian faith. It must be recognized, however, that the shroud's historical bond to ancient Edessa is constituted solely of its having accompanied this late 2nd century Eleutherian mission, and that the lack of any reference whatsoever to the presence of a Christ image in that city during the 3rd, 4th, and 5th centuries is attributable to the circumstance that promptly after Abgar was baptized, the relic was restored to the Antiochian church and did not return to Edessa until the destruction of Antioch by the Persian army. It is therefore in the year 540 that the ancient history of the shroud concludes and that its medieval history, as so thoroughly documented by Wilson, begins. Thank you very much for your kind attention, and I sincerely hope that you will have the opportunity to read my entire paper when it's published later this year in the Acts of this Conference.
Explore the mystery at shrouduniversity.com.